You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, the money just keeps pouring in.
I am obviously flattered and, deeply honoured to have people ask me and people encourage me. And I am thinking about it, but I am going to continue to think about it.
So why won't Hillary Clinton declare that she wants to be president in 2016? John Owen and Zania Dormandy will join me to explain. Then we'll be in Italy as the country struggles to handle the influx of illegal migrants crossing the Mediterranean. And we'll hear why Kenya is cracking down on their Somali population too. Plus we'll discuss the Boston bombing and ask why Russia refused to share crucial intelligence that might have prevented the attack. We'll also review the best books from the month with Monocle's Robert Bound. We'll head on a road trip in South America with our Buenos Aires correspondent. And we'll discuss design at Salone del Mobile.
We are launching a collection by Alberto Lievore and Alter Molina, Spanish designers that are, I think, one of the most popular, more prestigious ones now in the world.
So, lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Before we begin all of that, though, let's catch up on the latest world news. Here's Jonathan Wheatley.
NATO's Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe has released images today of a Russian military build-up of 40,000 troops near the border with Ukraine. The Secretary-General Anders Rasmussen said any further military action by Russia would lead to grave consequences and severe economic sanctions. On a visit to Berlin, Russia's first Deputy Prime Minister Igor Shuvalov warned that imposing further sanctions on Moscow would not work.
My belief that everything will become better and quieter, and the Western world stop, always saying something about new sanctions. And I think that everybody will feel real comfort if it is a friendship and cooperation around the table rather than pushing us under the pressure of the sanctions. It's impossible.
The United Nations investigator on North Korea has urged patience in the probe into North Korea's human rights violations. UN human rights investigators said last month security chiefs and possibly Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un himself should be tried for ordering systematic torture, starvation and killings, while Marzuki Darusman said any action should not be rushed.
We would like to take this one step at a time and perhaps deal with the meeting in the first instance, and gauge the and assess the conditions as to the likelihood of having this report considered by the Security Council to be referred to the ICC.
Initial results in Indonesia's general election have proved disappointing for the opposition Democratic Party's struggle. It only won about 19% of the national votes, well below the 25% needed to nominate its popular presidential candidate, Joko Widodo. The results raise concerns Southeast Asia's biggest economy and the world's third largest democracy could be entering a period of political uncertainty. Jyoti Pujinyono Susanto is a trader with Valbury Asia Securities.
They didn't have the concrete votes from all over Indonesia, which made that he have to accommodate another coalitions with other parties, and they now market try to map which one of the candidates will run.
The Irish President Michael D. Higgins has continued his historic state visit to Britain with visits to Downing Street and a banquet at the Guildhall in the City of London. In his speech, he said that the intertwined histories of the two countries had known great turbulence, but his visit had come when the relationship had never been more friendly or respectful. And he praised trade links between Britain and Ireland and said the relationship between the two countries had come a long way.
The intertwined histories of Ireland and Britain have indeed known great turbulence, but we meet at a time when the relationship between us has never been more friendly or respectful. The vibrancy of this relationship now irrigates every aspect of our societies, as you have said. Tonight it is perhaps appropriate, then, to recall and emphasize the social, cultural and economic currents in that relationship.
And finally, a painting that was auctioned for 28.8 million Hong Kong dollars 3 days ago has gone missing, police said, with media reports suggesting cleaners may have inadvertently thrown the artwork out. The 2012 painting, Snowy Mountain, by the Chinese artist Kui Ruho, was reported missing by the Chinese auctioneer's Poly Auction. And that story ends this bulletin of Monocle 24 News.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. I just wonder whether somebody might have been framed over that incident.
Possibly. We better check the rubbish.
That's Jonathan Wheatley with the news. He'll be back at the bottom of the hour with the latest world news headlines for you. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're back right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres... Essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, eu sou London. This is Monaco 24.
Orlando, tu é Monaco 24.
Para London, dette er Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London, Europa.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is, a whisker before 7 minutes past the hour, 13:07 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the news of the day here in Studio One are both John Owen, chairman of the Frontline Club and professor of international journalism at City University London, and Zainia Dormandy, director of the US programme at Chatham House. Welcome back to the programme, both of you. Great to have you with us, as always. Now, US voters will be heading to the polls this November in midterm election, but the country is already talking perhaps a little more about who they want for president in 2016. For Democrats, there seems to be only one name in the frame, Hillary Clinton. In a moment, we'll ask about some of the money pouring into her as yet still unannounced campaign. But first, Monocle's Phil Hahn looks at the candidate in this report.
Will she or won't she? That's the million-dollar question. Hillary Clinton raised eyebrows this week after a particular question left her speechless.
She says, in 2016, would you prefer to be called Madam President or Mrs. President?
Clinton never answered the question. Speculation has been growing over the last few months as Democrats look towards 2016.
Answer.
Well, I'm getting to it. So let me say this, that give me your name and number.
Chatter is reaching fever pitch.
I think she actually said the truth.
Oh,
she hasn't
Dini.
Decided. Why is
Dini,
that?
Why do you? Why
because
is the official word from the people around her? Talk to this
Wait,
other person.
Why is
who
the
will
official word?
You.
Because the people around her will actually talk to her.
But to lay claim that she will run, more than a dozen political action committees have been set up to start raising money. Ready for Hillary is one PAC that has already raised millions of dollars.
This is who we want. We may see less a nomination fight and more of a coronation if Hillary Clinton decides to do it.
But the Republicans, despite having no frontrunner, say Clinton will still find it tough.
I think Hillary Clinton is going to struggle to win on multiple fronts. First, she's going to be asked to account for her time in the Secretary of State. And I don't think it's the sterling success people think it is. Quite frankly, much of the foreign policy failures that we see in place today began when she ran the Department of State.
Senator Marco Rubio there, Benghazi, is definitely something the GOP will try and put on her.
The fact is, we had four dead Americans. Was it because
of
a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make?
But as we approach November midterms, the race for 2016 will only intensify. Will it be a yay or a nay?
I haven't made up my mind.
I really
have not. I will look carefully at what I think I can do and make that decision, sometime next year.
For Monocle, I'm Phil Hahn.
That was Phil Hahn reporting on Hillary Clinton's, well, campaign, I'll say, in inverted commas. Zania, it was interesting, one thing that struck me in that piece, suggesting it could be a coronation, not a nomination. What's your take on this? Are we just biding our time? This is definitely going to happen, isn't it?
I guess two comments. I don't agree that it's either a coronation or a nomination. I think that she is by far the leading Democratic candidate. I don't think it's a guarantee that she will put herself forward. I mean, this is a facile thing to say, but she'll put herself forward if she thinks she can win it. She will, because of name recognition, she's able to resist actually putting her name on the dotted line until well after we kind of have a pretty good sense of what the Republicans are going to do. And I think she will look and see who the Republican candidate is or looks likely to be, and then she'll make a decision. If she thinks she can win it, she'll put her name forward. Even if she does put a name forward, she will have competition. I mean, you know, a lot of people are talking about Elizabeth Warren, who, you know, is she a credible candidate? It's too early to tell. I mean, she hasn't done anything yet. She was only elected a year ago, year and a half ago. So, I mean, there's a lot more to be seen. You know, people talk about Joe Biden, the vice president. Will he put his name forward? There's reason to believe that he might if he thinks he can. So I certainly don't think it's a coronation. I do agree with what Phil was saying earlier in that piece that it's not going to be easy running. And I think Marco Rubio mentioned this. She's got some... the reason that people like governors to run for presidents is because they haven't actually voted on any bills. And so they've actually been able to kind of stay in the gray space. Hillary is not in the gray space. You know how Hillary votes and feels and what she wants to get done, as a result of which the people who disagree with her have an awful lot of pegs to bring her down with. So it's not going to be easy running.
John, do you sort of share that view that actually it's not going to be as straightforward as perhaps some people are suggesting?
I do. And by the way, some governors can implode. Governor mm-hmm. Christie in New Jersey is a
Absolutely.
Perfect example.
Mm.
I would quote that great American philosopher, the baseball player Yogi Berra, who said it's deja vu all over again. I'd be a little nervous. You know, I was in New Hampshire 2008 walking around with friends following Barack Obama when there was this establishment candidate was about to be anointed, Hillary Clinton. There's a danger that Hillary becomes again the assumed leader and everyone starts to take potshots at her. She's gathering all now the Obama people, Jim Messina, who is a campaign manager. All the heavyweights are moving to Hillary. That makes her prey for someone like Elizabeth Warren. And on the Republican side, Rubio or Ted Cruz or these other people, to look at her and say, this is the ultimate establishment candidate. You know, do you really want Hillary? She's a boring speaker.
Well, I want to just, before you chime in, I was going to say, Zania, you mentioned that point about name recognition. And it is interesting. I mean, what does the Clinton name yeah. mean to people in America today? You know, is it necessarily a positive? I mean, there's presumably some people for whom that has a lot of baggage.
She will... I mean, the first thing I'd say is I think that we have a very different Clinton today from the one we had 6 years ago, you know, running against Obama in 2008. It's a very different Clinton. It's a very much smarter Clinton in many respects. If you see her in action today, it's a very different person. And she's running much more on her own name and her own reputation than she was doing 8 years ago. Her name actually is as you point out, is a disadvantage.
You're matter of fact about that. It's not,
oh, yeah.
It doesn't play
no
to
question.
Her.
It's the name. I mean, the irony, the only way that her name will not be a disadvantage if she comes off against Jeb Bush. And then you have Bush Clinton. You'll have a lot of people who won't vote, but it's Bush Clinton. So, you know, both of them have the same name challenge, as it were. So I don't think her name is an advantage, but I do think she is a very, very different candidate today than she was. And she's a much smarter candidate today than she was 8 years ago. But I agree with you. If she gets anointed, that's a real problem for her.
And whether the people around her really do get social media this time.
You know what? She will take over Obama's social media campaign. And I think every sense I get is the Dems are still so far ahead of the Republicans on this particular issue. You know, I think she's got that advantage. She's going to get women. Depending on who the Republican nominee is, she's most likely to get any Latino immigrant or, you know, associated with. She'll probably get the black community. She's likely, again, depending on who the Republican candidate is, she's going to get the young people. She's going to get the base, conservative base, who loved her husband, Bill. She's got a lot of things going for her. But the Republicans, if they choose smartly... It's a big question.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because as you said, there's one battle, which is to actually get this nomination. Maybe that's not a foregone conclusion, John, particularly some of the reasons that you outlined there. If she does, though, and she agrees to stand, you know, is there really a credible GOP candidate who could actually defeat Hillary, do you think?
I think Rubio is a very interesting guy. I mean, it is time perhaps for an Hispanic. We've had the first African-American. Rubio's very articulate. Doesn't have much of a record in the American Senate, but he could galvanize the Hispanic American community and maybe put them into play. I think he could be very formidable. I think this guy Ted Cruz is a bit of a nut job, but he also has his base among the Tea Party. Christie was supposed to be formidable, but he's now again run into all these problems.
I just wonder, Zenia, in terms of how coherent the sort of grand GOP strategy is, though, they may even find a decent candidate, but politically, will they be able to bind all of these disparate elements? Because the GOP, let's face it, has been in something of a funk. It's a bit of a mess. Can anyone sort of
So the GOP actually has some great candidates. I mean, you know, Christie is actually a really credible candidate. A lot of people are writing him off now because of the whole bridge debacle, which I won't go into. Suffice to say, there was a major bridge debacle. I don't think he's written off. I think that Jeb Bush is a really strong candidate. I personally don't think that Rubio or Cruz are going to be good candidates because they represent, and this is to your point, they represent a significant minority of the party, i.e. the Tea Party side, but they antagonize too many others. So you're not going to get, I mean, the reality is the primaries, you go to the edge, the election, you come into the middle. The Ted Cruz's and the Marco Rubio's will not win because they cannot get the middle voters.
But do you think there's any, are there enough people within the Republican movement who think about political expediency in that way and will say, look, these are not...
Yes.
There
yes.
are enough still.
And if you listen to some of the things that are coming out of some of the more centrist candidates or more centrist Republicans, not candidates, but kind of foreign policy watchers, et cetera, they are saying again and again and again, we need to get a credible candidate, i.e. somebody who can appeal to a majority of Americans, not just a small subsection. Although,
but
I think the Republicans will shoot themselves in the foot myself.
But they've got to tame those who really do influence the right, and that is Fox News, Rush Limbaugh,
yeah.
and every wannabe Rush Limbaugh in American talk radio.
Yeah.
They have an influence well beyond their numbers, and they're the ones who've driven the party to the right.
And the reality is, you know, it's too early to tell, but every indication shows, particularly if the Republicans win the Senate in the midterm in 4 months, 6 months, that the Republicans will shoot themselves in the foot.
Just very briefly on this before we move on, this money that comes rolling into the PACs, as Phil was describing, millions and millions of dollars, this is just a facet of this race, isn't it? I mean, is it a slightly curious situation that you have all of this money rolling around? Is that unhelpful, or do you think it's just a part of the political process that we just have to be familiarise ourselves with and not worry about?
I think it's, you know, you saw the vote last Wednesday, the Supreme Court vote that essentially said, yes, there can be more money from individuals going to as many candidates as they want. I mean, it's a little bit more nuanced than that, but effectively that's what it was. There's going to be even more money than ever. The 2008 election, or no, the one before that, 2004, was essentially 100,000 million. Does that make? No, 100 million was spent. Last year, it was 2 trillion that was spent. I mean, the numbers are going up exponentially, and they're going to continue to going up exponentially. We may not like it, but it's a fact of life today.
Does that worry you, John, that kind of money, or it's just a fact?
Well, it's a longer discussion. It's just hideous what has happened since the Supreme Court decision, the Citizens decision in 2008 that said corporations have the same rights as individuals. They're all awash in money. Hillary's getting huge money from these super PACs, as they call them. Everyone's getting the money. It's just a broken democratic system in terms of campaign financing.
That's a slightly downbeat note, but we'll move on. I'm sure we'll revisit that in the coming months and indeed years. Let's leave US politics behind us now for a moment. We'll turn instead to Italy, the ongoing situation there concerning illegal migrants. Yesterday, the Italian Navy rescued more than 1,000 people from several overcrowded boats in the Mediterranean, one of the highest number, indeed, of illegal migrants rescued during a single 24-hour period. They're now being taken to detention facilities near the port of Augusta in the country. The situation continues to worsen, little end in sight, John, yet we've seen so many serious incidents, hundreds of deaths at times. Is there been a failure, some kind of collective failure then to galvanise, you know, the EU, political movements within Italy? Why are we still seeing these terribly unfortunate people in these terrible straitened conditions?
Well, I think you have to give a few accolades to the Italians. They've taken this on in a way that it's been visited upon them. This is where the joined up thinking of failed states and all of the policies in Africa and North Africa come together. I mean, you've got Africans who are in Libya being forced out, making a run for it. You've got the Somalis thinking that this is a better option. A.A. Gill wrote a brilliant piece that I happened to chair a journalism committee that gave him an award called Welcome to Death Island. And he wrote this piece and he said, as the boats approach, the difference between a migrant and an exile or a refugee is clear. The people are running from something, not to something. They're desperate to escape what they've gone through. They've spent 4 years, $6,000, and in last December, November, 300 perish. It is a hellish life that they've run from, and they have no certain future ahead of them.
It's such an acute situation, Zania. I mean, is it unhelpful perhaps then to sort of start finger pointing? Should we commend the admirable efforts that have been made indeed in some quarters, and just it remains to be seen how we tackle this broader problem? Do we have to go right back to the source perhaps?
Well, I mean, the answer is, like most problems, you can't attack it from one place. You've got to attack it from multiple places. So, you know, to John's point, they're running away from something. So we actually need to be attacking that challenge that is making them become migrants, become exiles, become refugees from their country, whether it's in Somalia, whether it's in Eritrea. And so a lot of effort needs to be put into that side. You know, of course, it's causing all sorts of ructions within Europe, you know, where Europe is becoming increasingly, many Europeans are becoming increasingly populist. Increasingly, we should not let immigrants into our countries. They're taking our jobs. This is happening in the UK. It's happening in much of continental Europe as well. You know, and so you're seeing the pushback against these migrants, against these immigrants, against these refugees coming into those countries. That's a real problem. We have to be fighting that problem as well. We have to be fighting the problem of, you know what, none of us actually have enough jobs. None of us have the resources to provide social services to many of these people, our own citizens, let alone others. And so how do you kind of create a fair distribution of resources? And how do you explain that to your peoples? I mean, there's a whole set of challenges here, and we need to be addressing each and every one of them.
You know, even in the countries of choice, and the countries of choice have been Norway, Switzerland, other Scandinavian countries, there has been a backlash, a blowback from this, where you do see the emergence of, in your words, sort of rightish policies who are taking a position against the special treatment being given to these exiles. So even in the most enlightened, welfare-driven countries, there's definitely a consequence.
But what you don't want, I mean, there are parts of Asia, there's parts of the Middle East, not least Palestine, you know, where you know, Jordan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, where you've essentially, for decades, you've had camps that these people are sitting at, waiting to be processed, waiting to build their lives, having children who are also not being educated, who are not being provided with jobs, who are not. I mean, this is a long-term challenge that we collectively need to find solutions to. But I'm with John in saying I think the Italians, under the circumstances, seem to be doing a pretty good job.
Let's move on Midori House. So you're still with me, Tom Edwards, my guests, John Owen and Zania Dormandy. When we return after a very short break, we'll discuss why Kenya continues a crackdown on its Somali migrant community, and we'll discuss the Russian-American relationship in the light of some fresh allegations that Moscow refused to hand over intelligence that could have prevented the Boston bombing. Stay tuned.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, still with me, John Owen and Zania Dormandy. Now, before the break, we were discussing the worsening situation in Italy concerning migrants trying to cross the Med. Now we turn a little further south to Kenya. The government there has been cracking down on its Somali migrant population, arresting hundreds of people, moving them from urban centres and out to camps. They blame Somali militants for several attacks in Nairobi and across the wider country. John, if I can start with you, you've just returned from Kenya. What's the sense there when you talk to people about the sort of broader attitude towards this crackdown? Because it seems very, very brutal. It seems to be on an extraordinary scale. Is it being met with shock? Are people generally fairly sanguine about it? What was your sense?
They're scared. They're terrified. There is great fear in Kenya right now, and it all goes back to the Westgate Mall bombing in September that played itself out over 3 or 4 days, and there are a lot of conspiracy theories that still exist about, well, where are the perpetrators? We were told they were killed because there was so much army and police looting in the mall. A lot of people think there was some kind of correlation between the Somalis and those that did this in the army. So there was a lot of fear, and almost every day, and it's not making big world news because there's so much else going on in the world. There are explosions last Monday in a poor part of Eastleigh, which is teeming numbers of Somalis there. It's like a country unto itself. You know, 6 to 8 people in a very poor food court were killed when explosives were thrown in. They've been rounded up and put into a football stadium to try to get at, you know, who's responsible. There are flights going over Eastleigh. They're looking for people. There is a lot of fear, and people are arming themselves. Very, very worrying times.
I just wonder, where does this lead us then? We've seen thousands of arrests, that sense of collective fear, as you mentioned. Where does this end?
Well, one thing I didn't say, and if you do talk to people and you press them about what's going on, they'll say it's payback for us being part of the African Union military operation in Somalia. This is payback, and this is why the Somalis are coming in and they're punishing us because we're the most accessible. So they would like to get out of the Somali African Union military operation.
And do you think there is any sort of, I mean, either of you, any sort of short-term endeavors that any of the actors in this could do to try and ameliorate the situation? I mean, or
well, here's just another quick problem. You have the president facing an indictment. Yeah. At The Hague. He goes in October, likely. The vice president is on trial there now. So that part of the operation is also in trouble.
I mean, the only thing I was going to say, this is a problem that isn't exclusive to Kenya. You know, we were talking earlier about refugees, about immigrants, about migrants within countries. These are problems that are pervasive across parts of Africa, they're pervasive across parts of Asia. There's a lack of transparency, there's insufficient governance. I mean, the list of challenges, you know, there's militaries and policing that don't have the required training and the required resources to actually do their job properly, that aren't getting paid enough. You know, again, that there are so many challenges here. And one of the problems that we always face in the policy domain is, which one do you start with first? Because you can't actually do everything at the same time. And so, you know, is this the right response? No, clearly it isn't the right response. You know, but as John said, you also have leadership that's actually being prosecuted in The Hague right now. There's lack of transparency. There's high levels of corruption. There's a lack of good institutions. There's lack of good governance. The list goes on. And again, how, if at all, can the international community assist this?
Time is against us, unfortunately. I'd like to talk more about that. But before we say goodbye to you both, I'd just like to talk briefly about this news of, the worsening, if anything, of the situation between the United States and Russia, not Ukraine for once, but the Boston bombing. New documents revealed the American authorities requested intelligence from Moscow about Tamerlan Tsarnaev, one of those involved, of course, 2 years before the attack in Boston. Some lawmakers on that side of the pond suggesting this was a big missed opportunity. Zania, I know you have some sort of homeland security expertise. Why didn't the Russians want to help? Or is that a gross sort of oversimplification of this?
I think it's probably, you know, I'm not terribly much of a fan of Russian actions in recent weeks. I don't think they've been helpful at all. That's an understatement, clearly. But I think we need to be careful not to read too much into this. Intelligence services don't like to share intelligence. It makes them very, very nervous. They don't actually like to share it within their country, let alone between countries. They really don't like to share it, not even with allies, but with people who aren't allies. So the idea that the Russians didn't actually give every single piece of information they had available to the Americans, I don't think we should make too much of that fact. It doesn't surprise me in the slightest. And it's unclear. I mean, even the reporting says it's unclear that even if the Americans had known of this, would it have actually made any difference? And so it's very easy to kind of retrospectively look at facts and say, oh, well, if only we would have. And this is yet one more sign that the Russians are antithetical to our values and are trying to bring us down and want us to be hurt, et cetera, et cetera. I think we need to get off that idea, at least for this particular fact.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. The clock is against us. But to both of my guests today, that's John Owen, chairman of the Frontline Club and professor of international journalism at City University, and to Zania Dormady, of course, director of the US program at Chatham House. Thank you both very much indeed for joining me on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's programme. We'll be in Argentina, we'll be in Italy, all around the world, as always, on Midori House. Before all of that, though, let's get the latest world news. Here's Jonathan Wheatley.
Thank you very much. NATO Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe has released images today of a Russian military build-up of at least 40,000 troops near the border with Ukraine. The Secretary-General Anders Fogh Rasmussen says any further military action by Russia would lead to grave consequences and severe economic sanctions. The United Nations investigator on North Korea has urged patience in the probe into North Korea's human rights violations. UN human rights investigators said last month security chiefs should be tried for ordering systematic torture, starvation and killings. And initial results in Indonesia's general election have proved disappointing for the opposition. It won only 19% of the national votes, well below the 25% needed to nominate the Democratic Party struggles presidential candidate Joko Widodo. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. That's Jonathan Wheatley. He'll be back with a full bulletin of world news for us at the top of the next hour. That's 1900, of course, here in London. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House, live on Monocle 24. And, well, it's time for us to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. We're heading to Buenos Aires to speak to Ed Stocker. But it's, I don't know, an R man in check-in with a difference, because Ed has been on something of a road trip, and we're going to find out exactly what he's seen while he's been out there. Ed, welcome to the show. Great to speak with you. Over 6,000 kilometres. Can this be right?
Yes, quite a long way. We thought it would be perhaps slightly easier than it was. This was leaving from Buenos Aires and heading to La Paz in Bolivia via the province of Cordoba. As you say, 6,000 kilometres, so it's quite a lot of driving. I did have a slight sensation that I spent over half the trip in the car. It was intimate, to say the least. I was with two other journalists, so we got to know the good and the bad side, I guess, of each other's personalities during the 2 weeks that we were travelling.
Well, as long as it was only personalities and not personal hygiene, Ed, that's fine. Tell me about some of the things you found on the way. What about in Cordoba itself? What did you see there?
Well, there's been a bit of an outcry against a Monsanto plant, Monsanto being the huge US agro giant that really has quite an influence, not just in Argentina, really, but across the whole region. They've been trying to build a new plant there in a place called Malvinas Argentinas, just outside the city of Cordoba. This has been blocked essentially by hundreds of people blocking the entrance to the plant. Monsanto not particularly popular in Argentina or the region amongst many people. They're responsible for the majority of GM crops that you see in this country. But also, they're seen as being responsible, certainly in Cordoba, for some of the dodgy, one might say, practices of fumigation, of crop spraying. There was a landmark case at the end of 2012 against some sprayers for basically fumigating too near to an urban population. The people there are saying that children are born with skin allergies, with respiration problems. Even one mother who said that her daughter died as a result of the spraying. Monsanto is seen as being directly linked to that because of the large majority of crops that it kind of controls, and the fact that its Roundup brand is very much used on a large percentage of crops. So I was visiting this camp that's blocking the entrance to this new plant and talking to some of the people involved, saying that, you know, not much has changed despite that 2012 landmark case.
Intriguing stuff. One imagines we probably haven't heard the last of that, Ed. What about when you travelled a little further afield? What about when you're in Bolivia from La Paz? Where did you head? I gather some more sort of, well, a bit of a different agricultural story, really.
Indeed, slightly different. The coca leaf, misunderstood and obviously largely connected, and rightly so at times, to the production of cocaine. But one needs to understand too that, you know, the huge cultural importance of the coca leaf. This is something that, you know, the ex-president Evo Morales is an ex-coca farmer. People chew the leaf, everyone from farmers to miners, to keep them awake. It's got 16 alkaloids, something I learned along my trip, many of them with health benefits, one of which is cocaine. But obviously to actually make cocaine, you need a huge amount of the leaf, and then it's concentrated. People arguing in Bolivia that, you know, in its natural form, it's not bad for you at all, and it's not a drug either. So interesting to meet the people growing the crop in a place called Los Chungas, just outside La Paz in the jungle area. Also meeting people growing organic coca with a view in the future to hopefully being able to export. People frustrated, I guess, by the way they see themselves as being demonized more than anything by the United States. One needs to remember that Coca-Cola does actually include a coca leaf extract in it, albeit without the cocaine. So interesting to see suddenly what they were saying, a double standard, I guess, internationally.
Indeed, it's really intriguing, Ed. How did you find your trip generally then? I mean, I was joking about how tired and weary you must have been after covering all those thousands of kilometres. What's that experience actually like, driving so extensively through Argentina and some of its neighbours? Did you get into any scrapes? I imagine that you're never too far away from a good yarn, I imagine.
Well, you realise that actually Argentina feels like a bit of an organised paradise after being in Bolivia. Not that I'm saying anything is wrong with Bolivia, but it's quite chaotic, to say the least, and a few things went wrong. For a start, you actually, foreigners have to pay three times as much for petrol. This is because petrol is heavily subsidized. And before the rule was brought in, there was a lot of trafficking to neighboring countries that had much higher prices. So they brought this rule in. So it actually ends up being pretty expensive to get around. We actually had natural gas tank in our car as well, which made things slightly easier, and tried to find a few friendly Bolivians to buy petrol for us at local prices. That did work on one occasion. But aside from that, a few social conflicts. Every time I've been in Bolivia, there seems to be some massive conflict paralyzing the country. In this case, it was a miners' blockade. They were protesting against a new mining law that actually ended up being suspended. But they decided to blockade the entrance and exits of all the major cities in Bolivia, which, when you're driving and not getting a plane, is slightly problematic, to say the least. So we did indeed take a few detours to try and avoid the the motorway where they were blockading, following a few cars into the middle of nowhere, dusty tracks, driving around kind of desert-like terrain in the middle of the night, trying to avoid the section that was cut off by the miners, or taking a sort of a valley tour in our clapped-out car that really couldn't manage to get up the hill, having to get out at push at 8 o'clock in the morning, having not slept at 4,000 metres. And I tell you, your lungs really don't have that much energy to push when you're that high. So those were some of the things that we were involved in that, you know, made it a trip that I won't forget easily, that's for sure.
Well, for good and bad reasons. Ed Stocker, our man in Argentina, thank you very much for speaking to us from Buenos Aires and, well, relating this tales of your extraordinary journey. Glad you're back safe and sound. Up next on Midori House, though, we'll be heading to Salone del Mobile. We'll speak to designer Renato Preti when we come back right after this.
It's a green thumbs up from us for Tokyo's leading flower market and auction, where merchants indulge in the business of buying blooms.
The Japanese flower market is the place for perfectionists. Anyone looking for a branch of cherry blossom just before it flowers, or a blemish-free orchid with every flower facing the same way.
Blooms or Bust, a photographic essay on the Ota Flower Market, now showing in the film section on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, just before 18:41 here in London. Discipline is one of the newest young pretenders on the Italian design scene. Established by Renato Preti just 2 years ago, the brand is committed to sustainability and natural materials and works with designers established and emerging Italian and non. Its opening night soirees, hosted in its charming garden in the centre of town, has become one of the highlights of the evening bashes. On Monday night, guests were treated to drinks and a saxophonist walking around serenading them, and plenty of great new products to ogle. Founder Renato walked our design editor Tom Morris through some of his favourite pieces there and discussed his dedication to doing things sustainably and, crucially, still stylishly.
Well, they are all my children, so all of them are my favorite, but especially they are all in line with our story, our values, that is about natural materials, sustainability, and beauty together. We are launching a collection by Alberto Lievore and Alter Molina, Spanish designers that are, I think, one of the most popular, more prestigious ones now in the world. They did a fantastic collection of chairs, stools, and tables in eucalyptus, which is a very sustainable wood because it grows so fast and kills all the kind of life in the forest. And it is a beautiful wood to look at. The chairs are very simple but with a strong character, like we like to be, and the price is very, very affordable considering that is high quality wood and high quality design. Then we are presenting, for instance, a table by Ras Beller, which has been awarded the prize for Designer of the Year by El Decor. He's Norwegian, very young, but growing very fast. And he did for us beautiful tables in Italian stone, pietra serena, and travertino, which are two Tuscany beautiful natural stones, and the base is in bay oak wood, and the interesting feature is that they travel flat pack, so you can assemble them in 10 seconds without screw and glue, and they're very stable thanks to the weight of the stone. Then we have a collection of chairs, also by Lars Beller, which is our best-seller designer. And they are dyed wood chairs. So the wood is not painted, it's dyed in water paint. So they are very sustainable, but also they look and they feel very natural. You can see the veneer of the wood. You can feel the special touch of the wood. But you can choose your favorite color. Mm. And then, well, we have many things, of course, but I'm very much in love with a collection of chopping boards or tray. You can use both ways. that have the shape of the pebbles in the beach, but they are made by, of wood or marble, black marble, and really have the shape of a pebble. I think they are very elegant and has been designed by a Japanese girl, a famous designer. She's called Nao Tamura, and I think they are really very emotional pieces.
It is quite amazing just the sort of the range of nationality of designers that you work with for a young, fundamentally Italian design brand. Is that, do you think, what sort of sets you apart?
Yeah, I think that we have a very strong identity, a very strong mission, which is, as I told you, natural materials, sustainability, but also beauty and high-end design. So we can afford to work with many different designers coming from many different cultural countries. So we can see how different cultures interpret, develop our philosophy. It's interesting to see how a Japanese designer is developing a product for us in natural materials or Italian materials like Carrara marble, or a Swedish one, or a Spanish, or a UK, or a US one, etc. It's very fascinating to see the different approach of different nationalities, because each one of them is bringing to our project their tradition, their history, their experience of their own nation, their own story. But everything is as a fil rouge, as a common denominator, which is our specific identity.
And do you, I mean, just going around Saloni, the word sustainable has been a buzzword for many years now, but actually very few brands properly commit to sustainability. Would you agree? Or
yes, I think that in the past, or if you look around, sustainability has been developed as something that comes from recycled material, something that has not the pleasure, the value of high quality products or design. What we do is to focus on high quality, so we don't want our clients to make any compromise to be sustainable. So we choose the best material, the best copper, the best wood, the best wool, the best leather, but not having any kind of synthetic products. We are not introducing into the natural any new material, and we do products that can last theoretically forever. For instance, if we do a stool in metal, it's enamel, not painted. And enamel steel can last for centuries, like a copper product. If you use the wood, we use the stronger wood you can choose, like oak or eucalyptus, which is very strong. So we always try to develop things that last forever is a stupid thing to say, but last many, many, many decades. And I think that is the best way to be sustainable.
Mm. A lot of the designers you work with are, I wouldn't say emerging, but certainly sort of quite young into their careers. Do you believe a kind of younger generation of designer are rewriting the rule book on what sustainable design is, in the way that perhaps a more established designer sees it as a sort of an annoying compromise to make?
Of course, we choose the designer not because they are young or emerging or old, but because they have an history and they have an attitude which is in line with our story, with our brand. But yes, I must say that young designers, especially from Scandinavia, UK and US, are very much and much more than the older one used to be very, very careful about sustainability. So they consider it a must.
That was Renato Pretti speaking to our design editor, Tom Morris. Be sure to tune into Section D on Tuesday night, 1900 hours London time, of course, for a special edition focused around all the exciting things at Salone del Mobile. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, we like to do our little review segment before the end of the show. It's Thursday. Let's talk books. What better time than a Thursday afternoon to head to your local bookshop? Maybe pick up a paperback or a hardback. It doesn't matter. Who better to tell us about his recommended reads for the week than Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound?
Howdy.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Tom. Great. I'm looking forward to getting my teeth stuck into some of the novels. Well, they're not all novels, are they, I suppose?
I don't know what you've got.
We're
going to
do a novel. Yes. We're going to do a biography, and we're going to do a book of sort of literary criticism.
Oh, that's a nice.
What do you
blend.
Reckon? A sort of we're going to straddle ourselves on the. Do you want to sit on in the sidecar with a motorbike of culture?
I'll ride there in time. I'll wear the little goggles.
Wear the little goggles
and throw my crash helmet off.
It'd be like two fat ladies, only yeah. sort of two fairly slimmish. Yeah. Fairly slimmish men.
Slimmish, shall we say, middle-aged gentlemen?
Middle-aged men.
Let's not say that.
Anyway.
Where should we begin? Should we start with a novel? Let's start with fiction?
Yeah, this is Benita Avenue by Peter Buwalda, who I think you interviewed the other day.
Had the pleasure of catching up with Peter Buwalda. He was in town because, of course, this is the first English language translation of his celebrated book that was published, I think, three or four years ago in his native Holland.
Yeah, I think it was three years ago. It caused a big stir. It's called Benita Avenue. It's just out in English. This is one of those nice things. It's a very handsome book. I'm holding it up there, which is, of course, no use for our listeners. We need a webcam in here, don't we?
We could. Well, that's
although then,
that's,
of course, they'd know
ill-advised.
That we weren't slim, yeah, slim exactly. young men. And it's an amazing, it's a novel of, sort of, you know, it's a bit of a sort of literary crit cliche, but it is a novel of primary colours. It's funny. I don't know. I wonder what he is like as a person. What was Peter Buwalda like?
He was a really interesting character. And one of the things that I was intrigued about was this idea of when your books are translated or optioned to be on, to be made into a TV show or a movie, which I think is possibly in the pipeline for him for this work. How concerned is he about keeping any kind of creative control and how good the quality of the scripts are that follow? Yeah. And he surprised me. He said, I'm not interested in the slightest. It's my creative vision. And then that's a completely different
product. I've written a story, and however you take that story,
And then he's like, then that's a TV show, or then that's a movie. That's different. And I couldn't quite go on to whether the same was true for the actual translation, presumably.
Yeah, right.
You'd be slightly more precious about that. But he was an interesting character. He was very laid back.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I couldn't tell what his sort of writerly style would necessarily be from chatting to him.
It kind of reminds me of a bit of a Martin Amis. He's very much, he's kind of like Martin Amis has always been, in a bit of a war against cliche. I mean, the set pieces in this book, it's a sort of decent sort of 450 page volume, this novel of his. It's always trying to find, it's kind of shocking, it's kind of hilarious. There are moments of very pointful absurdity in it. There's an explosion in a fireworks factory, which is one of the sort of set pieces of the book. It's really beautifully told. It's very funny. It's one of those novels that can fast forward. It's essentially, by the way, it is a sort of family saga. It's a bourgeois family saga.
And quite international, I gather. I mean, Benito Avenue itself is, of course, a street in California.
So it's sort of set all over the place. It's a melting pot of a book. But in terms of style, it's sort of very sort of primary coloured, broad brush strokes, very funny, and it's sort of quite satirical as well. I hear, because I'm not an expert on Dutch literature, but this is a sort of trope of contemporary Dutch literature, that there's a lot of satire of what is essentially a very bourgeois country. Why don't we hear about Holland in the news? Because not a lot happens, you know, not a lot of bad happens maybe. So this is maybe doing the journalism that we wouldn't normally hear about. Before we move on to the next book, I want to read the opening line, because opening lines are always what you want to keep an eye on. That Sunday afternoon in 1996, when Aaron let Joni Sigerius cajole him into going along to her parents' converted farmhouse in order to be officially introduced, her father offered him a handshake so firm that it hurt. "You took that photo," the man said. Or was it a question? And this is University Rector, judo champion and famed mathematician Seem Sigerius, and he's been driven mad with suspicion that this young boy that's the narrator, or this young man that's the narrator, is palming his stepdaughter, the young boy's girlfriend, off on a porn website, that he's kind of basically pimping her out. So this is how it sort of starts, and then goes on. It's a bit of a snowball of style, of substance, and it's hilarious.
Excellent. Well, that's a glowing recommendation.
It's a great back
to kick us off.
It's beautifully published by Pushkin Press here in the UK. What are we going to talk about next?
Where should we go next? Well, it sounds like he's a bit of an entertainer. What about one of the great entertainers, Mr. Charles Chaplin?
Yeah, so Peter Ackroyd, the sort of celebrated chronicler of London, his new book, and he's a pretty pokey writer, Peter Ackroyd. He sort of sticks a couple of books out a year. His latest biography is that of Charlie Chaplin. I mean, it's interesting, Peter Ackroyd doing Chaplin, because Chaplin was, of course, a great Londoner. He was a child who grew up in poverty in South London in the late 19th century and obviously became, as Peter Ackroyd describes him, the most famous man in the world, and an interesting man. I mean, there are things people sort of know about his, you know, his love for underage girls and his and of course the Little Tramp. And nobody knows much in between these sort of two facts. Are they facts, or
you mentioned about Peter Ackroyd being a chronicler of London, and he's one of these people who reveals the underbelly even of streets or sites or vistas people think they know very well, and he shows another side. Chaplin's life has been fairly well documented. Perhaps your man in the street maybe doesn't know all of the intricacies. Is there enough of a story that it requires someone like Ackroyd to still draw out a few extra bits of depth and detail?
It does. I mean, there's less what you might call sort of psychogeography, which is, I guess, something that maybe is more up Ian Sinclair's street in terms of sort of London chroniclers. But Ackroyd does like that thing. He likes to find the confluence of the rivers Fleet and Thames underneath what is now the Lloyd's Building, as we sort of famously know. In terms of Chaplin, this is actually quite a straightforward chronological book from birth to death, and I'm not entirely sure why that's sort of why Ackroyd's chosen to do it like that, but it doesn't sort of take much away from he doesn't weave all sorts of different things together. As I say, it's quite a straight account, but there's enough in Chaplin's story to kind of keep you hanging on for more, and it is fascinating. It's primarily fascinating. I think you still maybe don't know who the man is. You don't know who the Little Tramp is, really, at the end of reading this book. I think he was a man that lived for the very long hours he spent on set and on camera, always in the middle of the shot, and he hated it when the talkies came in, and he hated it when cameramen and directors wanted to move the camera, or when he felt compelled to move the camera around. Modern Times was, of course, his great masterpiece, which was done quite late in his career, and that was sort of done against the odds, against his own real wishes, actually, the way that sort of film turned out, I think. But so I think there's a strange thing that you don't see, perhaps, beyond the bowler hat, the baggy trousers, the boots and the walking cane and the little moustache. You don't see that much beyond that after this book, but you do have a great sweep of this man's life and about the great changes that's possible to have in a life, growing up in poverty and ending up rich, famous, and, to be perfectly honest, crazy. I mean, he died in a villa on the edge of Lake Geneva in Switzerland, having grown up, sort of as an almost beggar in South London. It's a rip-roaring tale. I think it could be done in sort of, you know, in anyone's words, but Peter Ackroyd's obviously an elegant turn of a phrase. So that's kind of a bit of a must read for the early part of this year.
Fantastic. That's Charlie Chaplin by Peter Ackroyd. Let's talk about David Lodge. Well, more lives in writing.
Yeah.
People may be familiar with David Lodge's his novels, his fiction, quite a sort of studied. I've always been rather a fan. Lives in writing, is this a great writer writing about great writers?
Writer writing about great writers, yeah. These are the sort of, the giants of the sort of early 20th century literature. There's Graham Greene, Muriel Spark. He writes about Philip Larkin as well, and Kingsley Amis. And these are the sort of people that sort of start off the book. And then he talks very affectionately about a person, a British novelist and literary critic and lecturer, Malcolm Bradbury, who he always got mistaken for, and it annoyed and then began to amuse both of them, because they were sort of both the term in literary criticism is campus novelists, weren't they? And they always got, they had maybe a similar writing style. They wrote about similar things. And Malcolm Bradbury, obviously David Lodge is still with us, he's still writing books. This came out a couple of weeks ago. He writes very affectionately about his late friend Malcolm Bradbury. But the book is so amazing, and it is a lesson. I think anyone before they buy a pen and buy a pad needs to read this book.
Three highly recommended.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Beneath Revenue, Peter Buwelda, David Lodge.
Under pressure, I like to pressurize my guests on Midori House into picking one favorite. A bit difficult when they straddle genres like that. If you could just take one away with you, Rob, what would it be of those three?
Can I have the speedboat? I think my bookshelf would be much poorer without Lives in Writing by David Lodge.
That's Robert Bound, Monocle's culture editor, guiding us through the best of books. Rob, thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme. And that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thanks in particular to my special guests, John Owen and Zania Dormandy, who talked us through whether Hillary Clinton will finally announce her campaign for 2016. We also discussed Kenya's brutal crackdown on Somali migrants in the country. Today's show is produced by Phil Hahn, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Janie Cho. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. That's all from this edition of Midori House.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.